Welcome to the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast, where it's all about slashing your debt and taxes and creating a liberated lifestyle. And now, your host, with a love of fantasy books and funk, and a hatred of running more than 3 miles, Dave Denniston.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast, a podcast devoted to helping you slash your debt, slash your taxes, and live a liberated lifestyle. This is Dave Denniston, your host, the coach for physicians' finances. And in this episode today, my friends, you are going to hear from Dr. Nee Darko. I just love this conversation. He is the doc outside the box. And in this conversation today, actually, I'm splitting it into two parts. So this is part one. And in part one here, you're going to learn about how his parents transformed into being his heroes. You're going to learn about the TV show that made him picture himself as a physician. You're going to learn about how whole life insurance shapes his view of financial advice and how it all transitioned into him making a horrible mistake in a club. And so in part one, you're going to really dive into, you're going to learn about how he thinks and how his thoughts about money have transformed over the last few years. I know you're going to love it. Make sure to tune in tomorrow to part two. Check it out. Let me know what you think. We'd love to hear from you, Dave at DrFreedomPodcast.com. And with no further ado, here is the interview with Nee. My name is Dave Denniston, your host, and welcome back to the latest episode of the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast. Well, welcome back, my friends, to our monthly fireside chat with a physician to get to know their journey, their joys, and their struggles with finances and outside of finances. This show is not always about actionable content. It is, however, a chance for you to see behind the curtains, to walk in another person's shoes, to experience their lives. Now, our next guest, he is not only a physician, but he is also exploring this question. What else am I besides a doctor? Where more value can I add to the world? Now, a little bit of bio. He is a practicing full-time board-certified trauma surgeon. And even on top of that, he's a fellow podcaster. And even on top of that, he is a New York Knicks fanatic. But I must add, he is not a fan of Phil Jackson.
Hell no.
But even more, he has a passion for a whole life insurance. No, just kidding. He doesn't, but we'll talk more about that and his experience with it. But beyond all of that, he has a passion beyond medicine. He is breaking outside the barriers, and I know he has a ton of wisdom to share with us. And with no further ado, please help me welcome Dr. Nee Darko, the doc outside the box. Welcome, Nee.
Hey, man. Thanks for having me on the show. Sorry to interrupt your intro, but that's how much I don't like Phil Jackson. I'm a big-time New York Knicks fan, fanatic since, you know, the early 90s. So, you know, I speak up when I can about the Knicks.
Well, you know, you were back in the Sprewell days. Oh, you know, yeah. You guys accepted him after he started choking people out.
Yeah, well, you know, he got us to the finals, so, you know, all is forgiven, right? But but I was a fan even before then. I was a fan when, you know, during the early Patrick Ewing years, you know, John Starks, those years. That's when, you know, those are the true memories that I have. But obviously when Sprewell and Allen Houston and, you know, some of the others, you know, they were able to get to the finals and they got thoroughly whooped by Tim Duncan. I was a fan then also.
Well, you know, it's so funny. You do podcasts, and when you listen to other people's podcasts, and then you actually get a chance to speak with them, it's like, man, I've been talking to this guy all the time. You just don't know it, man.
You feel like you have a natural connection, right?
I know, right? So I'm so glad you're here with us to share with everyone who may not be familiar with your podcast, Docs Outside the Box. So we're going to link it in the show notes. And as you know, this podcast, it's about empowering physicians with knowledge, how they can slash their debt, slash their taxes, and live a liberated lifestyle. And I know that financial knowledge for you, as I follow your show, is something that you've been acquiring through what I like to call the school of hard knocks. So before we get to that, let's just take a step back into the past for a second. First, tell us a little bit about you. Where'd you grow up? Outside of, we know it was New York, but what was your childhood like?
So I grew up in New York, grew up in Queens, New York, and then we moved to a city right outside of right outside of Newark, New Jersey, called Irvington, New Jersey. But my childhood was fun. It was great, very diverse. I grew up, like I said, in Queens, New York, in a place called Left Rack City, right across from Shea Stadium. So I was a huge Mets fan. I remember when Mookie Wilson hit that base hit, and I remember, you know, everybody in the housing complex that I lived was going crazy, and you can see the lights and the fireworks, you know, coming from Shea Stadium, and you know, those type of memories always, you know, stay true to me, or you know, they'll always stay with me. So sports was a big deal in my life, just because we lived so close to where the Mets were. I never grew up a Yankees fan, just because the Yankees weren't that good in the 80s. Excuse me. So I've always been a Mets fan, and then obviously I'm a Knicks fan, and I love the Giants and Jets. But then afterwards, we moved to New Jersey. We moved to a little bit outside of Newark, New Jersey. And for me, I have three older sisters. The youngest of them is a nurse, and now is a nurse anesthetist. So I just remember just being, you know, just the youngest one, causing problems, having fun. You know, my childhood was great. I really have fond memories. And it's interesting because I felt like, you know, I just had this natural dichotomy in my life. So I was raised in a African household, basically. My parents were from Ghana, West Africa. And, you know, just kind of having that upbringing, and then, you know, you're juxtaposing, you know, their American lifestyle with that. So at home, I'm eating, you know, Ghanaian food and African food, and then go to school and go to school with a dashiki on, or, you know, go to school, you know, with, you know, funny looking clothes, you know, to people here. It was very interesting, obviously, having a name that stood out. You know, back then I really wasn't very proud of my name, but now obviously, you know, very extremely proud of my name, because of, you know, it there likens and harkens to a certain history with my name, which, you know, some people really don't have. So for me, I'm very proud of my name now, but it's very interesting to kind of talk back and think about my childhood and the natural transition that I had from, you know, just being very awkward and not understanding why certain things are in my life, to now I'm very proud of those things. And it's just weird how that works out.
Well, it's in hearing you talk, a couple things that just struck me as we were chatting here. I'm a West Coast guy, grew up in California. And the perception out on the West Coast, you know, we think of East Coast people as being more aggressive, maybe more competitive.
Forget about it.
Loving, right. Loving their sports.
Get out of my way. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking in relation to growing up and academics and those kinds of things. Was it a really competitive environment? Is that a fair description of kind of the place you grew up, not just across the bay from Manhattan, or what was that like?
No, it wasn't a competitive environment, but it was, I just remember like the lifestyle or what happened outside of where we lived. You know, basically you can just describe where we lived was the projects. So where we lived and where we grew up, outside our apartment door was very different than what happened inside the door, you know. So my parents were very, you know, very lucky to have two parents in the household. Education was always pushed very hard in my family. My three older sisters protected me from everything that went on outside. So, you know, although there was a lot of ills and a lot of negativity that went on outside of the door where we lived, you know, I was really protected by my sisters, and I was really protected by my mother and my father. And education was always pressed in our household. We always had a certain level of confidence, just because we just knew that there was a certain level of expectation that our parents had on us. There was a certain level of expectation that I knew I had to keep up. And what was going on outside of where we lived, you know, even though it's a level of circumstance, not everybody in the projects is downtrodden or, you know, held in a negative light. You know, obviously, you know, we didn't fit that description, you know, but, you know, we knew that we wanted to get out of there. I knew I wanted to get out of there, and I knew early on that education was the way out. So for me, it wasn't a competitive environment, but just more of, just you have a lot to live up for. There's a lot of expectations on you. There's a lot of responsibility on you. And, you know, I always embraced it. I never had any stress from it. And it really helped me kind of transition from where We were in New York and where we grew up in Newark to, you know, where I am now. And it's the reason why I continue to push myself, because I know where I came from. And I know that if I can come from that, you know, and continue to succeed, there's really no stopping me. So.
Well, what's so beautiful about that? I mean, it's the American dream, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, coming overseas and here you are, first generation American, because you were born here, correct?
Not yeah, I was born here.
Ghana. And so as I think about someone doing that, I mean, that, to me, that's just amazing, for one. But when I think about money, obviously, it was hard for your parents to get going here. And obviously, they did the right things. And look at you now, being a physician. Was money something that they talked about a lot? Or how did that play into growing up with you?
So for me, or at least in our household, money wasn't talked about too much, except my parents told us to save. That was the biggest financial lesson that we had. Save your money. Hmm. That's it. Hmm. You know, no, we didn't get the, you know, you can save your money and then maybe start investing. I didn't really understand investing. We didn't talk about that. But I do remember every now and then that there would be some moments where, you know, the lack of money became very palpable in the household. Just leave it at that. There was one time, like in the late 80s, during a stock market crash, my father lost his job afterwards. And I remember it was a very scary, tense time. And although I don't know the specifics of the financials of my father at that time, I just remember it being a very tense time in the house. Everybody was very nervous. I remember my mother telling me, you know, you can't be playing around like crazy outside, because we don't have health insurance. So if you got hurt, you know, you got to be really careful with what you do. So that was a very nerve-wracking time. And I also remember just, you know, things like my father would get a car and he would come home and, you know, we have an okay car, but I remember my father not feeling very proud of the interaction that he had at the car dealership. Things like that always just kind of resonated. My parents are my heroes, and I think the experiences that I remember are things that, you know, when they went through situations and I can see that they weren't too happy about that, those things kind of ring with me. So I always knew that financially I wanted to make sure that I got into a profession where finances wouldn't be too much of an issue, or if it was, I really had control of that situation, because, you know, finances, obviously, in certain parts of my memory and certain parts of my childhood, you know, was a very important time, or was played a very pivotal role for me. So besides just saving our money, we really didn't get the lessons of trying to make our money work for us. And that's something that I think is just as important as just saving your money, obviously. Understanding that money can work for you in various ways, whether you're sleeping, whether it's working passively, I think that's just as important as obviously living within your means and saving your money.
Well, one thing that popped up for me as you were talking about these stories of your parents scraping by, and is sometimes that with everything that a parent has given their kids, that the kids want to pay it back. Is that something, if you don't mind me asking, that you are planning for, you know, to help your parents live comfortably after all the sacrifices that they've made for you?
Oh, absolutely. I'm standing on their shoulders. I would not be in the situation that I am right now without them. It's funny, I still go to my parents for advice, even though, you know, I am far exceeded what they've ever made in terms of income. I still go to my dad for advice on cars, advice on what should I do financially with this or financially with that. And they're very important to me. And as a result, financially, both me and my wife, we feel in debt, basically, in a good way, though, to our parents. And it's a sense or source of pride to be able to financially be able to provide for them in their later years. So for me, I don't look at it as a, you know, some people may look at it as a burden. But for me, it's a sense of pride to be able to do that, because I look at it, I'm like, well, they were able to take care of me on literally a quarter of what I make right now, maybe even less than that, you know, without any complaints. And granted, they had to do that. So with what I make and what me and my wife make, and eventually, hopefully, you know, if things continue to flourish with what I want to do, shouldn't be a problem to at least provide some sort of support to them.
Well, I got to imagine, I mean, that's motivation, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, yeah, that probably helps keep you going in medicine. And I would like to take a step back, Nee, for a second. When we look back at your growing up young in across New Jersey, and you're there with your parents, you're this wild, crazy, fun kid. At what point did you know you wanted to be a doctor? Tell us about that journey.
So I've been, you know, it's funny because this was something probably maybe 5-10 years ago, something that I was really proud to tell people about, but, and I'm still proud of it now, but it just rings a different bell. So for me, I watched a lot of TV when I was younger, not too crazy like today's youth do, but you know, I watched TV and I was influenced by what I saw on TV. So for me, the consistent person who was on TV, who was African American, held in a positive light, had a great wife, beautiful wife who was a lawyer, wonderful children, lived in Brooklyn, had a brownstone, was what? The Cosby Show. And he was a doctor, right? So, and he was an OB doctor. So for me, that's something that I looked forward to every Thursday. And, you know, I had during that time also sports figures who I wanted to be like. My father also, I wanted to be like, was an engineer. So those were some of the top three things that I really was interested in doing, which was, you know, I wanted to be an engineer. At one point I wanted to be an athlete, but if you've ever seen me or if you see a picture of me, you'll know why I'm not an athlete. I'm 5'10", you know, 160 pounds. So, you know, besides track and field, that's as far as I'm going to be able to go athletic wise. And obviously being a physician. And for me, I just kind of glamorized in my mind that lifestyle of a physician. I was like, okay, well, you know, I can get a wife like Claire Huxtable and I can have kids like, you know, like he has, and I can live in Brooklyn in a brownstone and have a practice in my basement or go to the hospital and have a practice. So it was something that was what it, that imagery resonated with me, even at a young age. And I up think until, what, go ahead.
I was going to say, I think what's so beautiful about that, I mean, even we don't know what really happened behind the scenes, obviously, but
right.
Nonetheless, I mean, to inspire people like that, I think is just amazing. Mm-hmm. And here you are, a young kid watching the show, enjoying it, being entertained, and it impacts your life.
Absolutely.
So did you start shadowing doctors when you were like in high school, or you know, when did you start making more and more of a commitment outside of watching the show to being in medicine?
So it's interesting. So I got accepted to Lehigh University and they had this pre-matriculation program for people from certain areas to come and at least check out the school and take some classes before school actually started just to get used to the campus. So I decided to go and met at a picnic this physician who worked, he was a trauma surgeon who worked in Newark and he was an alumni of the school. We talked and he invited me to spend a couple of times or a couple of shifts with him at University Hospital in Newark, New Jersey, which was at the time maybe about 5 blocks from my house. So I went there and I remember vividly the first night my parents dropped me off. He was waiting out in the intake area where all of the ambulances come. My parents talked to him for maybe about 5 to 10 minutes. They left and me and Dr. Garrison were talking. And literally within 5 minutes, ambulance pulled up, like all of these alarms kind of went off in the hospital. And he's like, look, we got to go.
Wow.
And then he came and he put me in a corner. And this is, I'm 17 years old. So I'm getting ready to go into freshman year of college, by the way. So I'm 17 years old. You know, I get put in a corner and it's just like chaos of nurses, med students, residents, just medical professionals going around this one patient. And this kid couldn't have been more than, I don't know, my age. So 17, he's screaming. Someone's checking his blood pressure. You know, this guy's screaming in pain. Someone's giving him pain medications. IV fluids are going in. All these different things are going on that literally at 17, I don't know what's going on. But to me, it was almost like this chaos, but chorus at some point almost. And Dr. Garrison is on the other opposite side, the opposite corner. And he's just like directing this almost like a maestro. And it's amazing. Like he's the conductor, just, you know, just saying, you do this, you do that. No, go here, go there. And eventually, you know, within, I don't know, to me, it seemed like 10 minutes, but it was probably quicker than that. They whisk him off to surgery. You know, obviously at that age, I had no type of orientation. I couldn't go up to the OR, but roughly about 2 hours later, he came back down and he's giving the mother of this patient, you know, a hug and letting him know that he's going to be okay. And he's speaking all the stuff that I don't understand, but you know, the mom just gives him the biggest hug. And when I'm watching this, I'm like, that's exactly what I want to do. He's the person I want to be like.
Wow.
And from that time on, I just knew that I wanted to do trauma surgery. I knew I wanted to go into surgery and do that type of lifestyle. And it's funny, the previous experience to that was being an obstetrical doc, right, from the Cosby Show. So I kind of struggled with that in med school, and I kept an open mind. But then eventually I just started gravitating to general surgery, and my experience in rural Kansas really changed and really solidified my thought process that I wanted to be a general surgeon. And then from there, the rest is history. I just did rotations in general surgery, and then I did my residency in general surgery, and then I kind of just gravitated, being in Atlanta, towards trauma surgery, and that's where I am now.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit. Here you are from the East Coast. You go to Kansas, of all places.
Oh, yeah.
So in terms of lifestyle, in terms of money, when I think of Kansas, I think of extremely low cost, whereas East Coast, I think both coasts as being very expensive. What was that like, you know, being in Kansas for you? Was it a culture shock? How did money play into that?
So look, let me be honest with you. So thinking about going to Kansas from New York, from New Jersey, you know, I'm a typical New York City prick. You know, like, I think everything revolves around being in New York and New Jersey. So I'm like, well, going out to Kansas, what's out there? You know, the world stops as soon as I pass the George Washington Bridge, or, you know, past the, you know, go past the Poconos or something like that. And being out in Kansas was one of the best experiences of my life, actually. I met my study partner, but now is my wife. And I've met some friends who I still have long lasting relationships with, but it really was a complete culture shock. And not in terms of diversity at all, because actually Kansas City is very diverse. Kansas City is one of the, you know, as you know about the southern migration of African Americans from the south to the north heading towards Chicago, you know, one of the places that they stopped at was Kansas City. And then obviously there's other cultures there. So it's very diverse, actually. But just in terms of just the Midwest lifestyle was just a culture shock to me. But it was one of the best experiences I've ever had. Got to meet people from way different walks of life from me, people who were raised on a farm, people who, you know, who consider Kansas City the biggest city that they've been in, you know, where for me, Kansas City is like a suburb, you know, you know, meeting people from different countries, you know, who are here just for med school. It was a phenomenal moment. And then for me, college, I struggled with, just because I just couldn't really understand like biochemistry, because it just wasn't explained in my terms. So, you know, if you can understand biochemistry in terms of like the Krebs cycle and all these different things, that's great. But in medical school, they teach it to you like, well, when someone has diabetes, this is what happens during a Krebs cycle. And you're like, oh, that makes sense. Now I get it. So in med school, I got to study everything that I always wanted to really know. And for me, it really wasn't that hard in medical school for me, because I was really invigorated. I was really excited to study what I have always wanted to do. So besides the culture shock, it was just a great experience. I'm going back for my 10-year reunion in October, so I can't wait. I haven't been back in 10 years. But
get some barbecue.
Oh, barbecue. You know what I'm saying? Gates barbecue, you know, and I just can't wait. It was great, though. It was great.
How interesting. Well, now you've gone to medical school and you're in residency now. And I jokingly mentioned in the intro how much you love whole life insurance.
Man, don't get me started on that, please.
Well, I want to know about this. So tell me about your experiences. How did this start out?
With what? With whole life or just with the School of Hard Knocks?
How did you run into it in the first place?
All right. So this is how it happened. So basically around my fifth year, someone came and bought us lunch during the lunchtime around lunchtime during residency. And I was a chief at that time. And the guy came and talked to us about, you know, how important it is to shore up our assets and to shore up all these different things. You got everybody who's listening to this, they know what I'm talking about. You know exactly what I'm talking about. So I gave the guy my phone number. He called me and we had some follow up, and then we talked at a coffee shop, and he got me to sign up for, you know, life insurance as well as for disability insurance. Okay. And I believe what I signed up. Go ahead.
So let me just read. So it was a seminar that this gentleman had at the in your residency program. So this wasn't medical school. This was your last year in residency.
Yeah, if you want to call it a seminar. I mean, he paid for lunch and then he kind of just started talking about stuff. And, you know, no, and come on. nobody's really listening, right? You're like, what, you bought Chick-fil-A? You know, so you come in and we're eating the food, and then he starts talking to us about stuff, and you're like, all right, I guess I'll listen to what you have to say. And so I gave him my phone number, and we followed up, and that's how it started.
Now, do you think that was this someone, because I find that a lot of residency programs, for example, they have an existing relationship with, like, let's say, Guardian. And there's basically people from Guardian that circle the residency programs or other companies. Was that your experience? Was it someone that basically?
No. They brought, this guy, he's a nice guy. He knew what he was talking about. Nice guy, represented what's the word? I guess it's almost like an advisory firm. And he came by, and I guess he talked to him and said, look, I'll buy lunch if you give me access to your residence, basically. And that's what he did. And then from there, he explained to me, you know, asset protection and understanding why I needed life insurance and disability insurance. And to be honest with you, I can't remember if he was pushing term versus pushing term and whole life. I can't remember if he was pushing both.
Well, let's just explain to people that maybe they're residents or they're medical students and they're listening. What's your perception of what is term, what is whole life? What is that?
Right. So for me, at that time, I didn't understand. But term basically is you have insurance for a set period of time. Most of it is what? 10, 15, or 25, or even 30 years. And then that's it. After that amount of years, you don't have any insurance after that. Whereas whole life, you have basically insurance for life, and you end up paying a certain premium to basically keep up that insurance. And depending on how much depth you want me to go into, I mean, there's components of that whole life insurance that is called a death benefit, and then there's also a portion of it that's called a cash value component also. And depending on, you know, how in depth you want me to go, basically your premium is going to end up paying for the death benefit as well as for the cash value benefit. And in terms of the differences between term life and whole life, you know, term life is a lot cheaper than cash value just because of the added components and the added advantages that you're seeing in cash value, or excuse me, in a whole life. So
now I want to know, you mentioned you got both disability and whole life insurance. So when you get to this point of figuring out, I'm assuming you're in practice at this particular point, that's like, oh God, this policy sucks. I'm paying 10 times what I should be paying for this. What did you do?
So actually I was, so what happened is I got life insurance and disability insurance in Atlanta. And then, you know, I was finishing up my chief year, and then I went down to Miami and I went to a party. And, you know, party's going off like crazy, you know, having a good time. And I bump into this guy, and we just start chatting and stuff. And he finds out that I'm a physician. And then he starts asking about insurance. And literally, as I'm getting the drink from the bartender, I roll my eyes. And I'm like, oh, Lord, another insurance agent. And he's like, look, tell me what you got. And we just started chatting real quick. And he's like, take my phone number. And I guess I should have never did that. But let's leave it to you like this. He ended up convincing me. And I guess you can kind of figure out, I'm very easy to convince. He ended up convincing me that basically the type of insurance plan that I had before, whether it's life and disability, I ended up basically replacing that with the plan that he had after about 5 or 6 meetings at my resident or at fellowship in Miami. We ended up I ended up changing it up and getting something that was even more expensive. Mm. It was a combination of term life and whole life. It was also disability. And, you know, it was manageable as a fellow. But then what happened is we continued to increase my plan as, you know, my income went up. So once I finished my fellowship and started doing locum tenens and then eventually had my job in Pennsylvania, I increased my, you know, the amount that I was putting in towards it dramatically. I went as far as, you know, talking to my other friends who were physicians and giving him their name, and he started connecting with them also. And then after a while, what me and my wife started noticing is that we couldn't pay our loans. We couldn't make an appreciable amount towards our loans because the majority of our money was going towards life and disability. And then let's talk about, you know, the pink price tag. I don't know if you ever discussed that on your podcast, but, you know, my wife, you know, was paying way more in disability than I was, close to about $700 a month. And, you know, for an unknown amount, for an unknown reason, basically. So that just caused a huge amount of concern. So we talked to him and said, listen, first of all, he didn't meet with us after we got married to discuss, well, maybe there has to be some type of change in the amount of coverage that they need since they've been married. That didn't occur. And then we started talking to him like, look, I think we need to pare down how much we're paying into these plans because, you know, to be honest with you, we're not able to make appreciable payments towards loans. And his answer to us or his advice to us was, no, I think you guys should leave the plan alone, but I think you guys should budget better. That call was made over, or that answer they gave to us was over speakerphone. And basically, wow. If you could like have a movie scene where literally it was just literally this eerie, you know, awkward, you know, like silence. And then the look that me and my wife had, it was literally like a someone done told this guy wrong moment. We were like, okay, fine. And I basically, at that moment, everything that I was telling you before earlier in the podcast of feeling like I was being taken advantage of for myself was something that I kind of related to how my father felt. And at that moment, I was like, never again. So I said, thank you very much for helping us. That's okay. And we hung up the phone. We didn't make any decisions to move away from everything. But at that moment, I said, I will never, ever feel like this again. I am the only one who cares about my money. Between me and my wife, we're the only ones who care about our money more than we do. And that's when literally the School of Hard Knocks started. And I just went on internet searches. I found a white coat investor. I found all of these different things that I was like, if I had known about these people online, if I had known about these YouTube videos, I would have found out about this a lot earlier. And I would have gotten myself out of trouble or not even walked into this situation. And, you know, I was looking out of anger because I was very upset. And that's how everything kind of got started. And that's how I started acquiring knowledge, realizing that I can kind of do this on my own. I started realizing that the person that I was working with, there's different tiers in which planners are being paid and so forth. And it was a very enlightening experience. It was something that I needed. Let's leave it to you like that. And it really helped me and my wife kind of realize that rather than handing over our finances to someone and saying, hey, you handle it, that it has to be more of a let's work together in this situation. What's your advice type of situation? Because I still believe, me and my wife still believe, and I think most physicians still believe there is a strong need for financial advisors. But I think from a physician standpoint, you have to look back and internalize and think, what is it that we can do to make this process a lot easier? What is it that we can do to make sure that we don't ever fall into the potholes that people like me, you know, like Dr. Darko had fallen into, or people who are still not awake right now are still going through right now, where they may be paying for products that they may not need, not fully understanding, you know, the products that they bought. What can we do to make sure that we don't get into that situation?
So if you're talking to a knee that's is his fifth year of residency, and you were going to warn him about this experience or just tell him about advisors, what would you advise him to do?
I think the first thing I would tell him to do is just relax, take a deep breath, and just go on the internet and just look up this information. Because I think nowadays, you know, obviously over the past 10, 15 years with the explosion of the internet, with just Google search, you can look up anything. You can go to YouTube and look up anything. And I'm not saying that you're going to acquire enough knowledge to do things on your own, but I think you can kind of understand and get at least a simple, basic understanding of the plans that are being pushed to you. And like I said, the first experience that I had, the one in residency, I don't think that was a bad plan that was put towards me. But I didn't fully understand it. And, you know, I don't think that he needs to break down everything for me, because I think in life we don't really have that. When we go and we buy, you know, whatever we may buy from a store or buy something from a mechanic, or even when we go to see our physician doesn't tell us every detail of everything that happens. Part of that responsibility falls on us to educate ourselves, to understand the specifics of the product that we're buying. So part of the blame, I think, definitely I put on my shoulder that I needed to better understand it. So that's one of the biggest pieces of advice I would give to myself is just make sure that you relax, just read up on this information first. Find out if you really need it. So for me at that point, you know, was it even necessary for me to get life insurance? At that point, I wasn't married. I don't have kids. I did have a plenty amount of debt. But yeah, was it really necessary to have life insurance at that moment? So that's probably the biggest piece of advice I would give to myself at that moment. It was just to just do more of an education, do more of take more effort into reading, whether it's, you know, going to the library or going online and reading more about, you know, the different products that are out there. And then also at the same time, you know, understanding my finances better, understanding budgeting. That's a big deal. Like, I didn't understand budgeting. I did mental math so that I wouldn't overdraft at the end of the month. But that's elementary. That's preschool, you know.
Totally.
The amount of budgeting I do now.
Let me point something out real quick for everyone who may not understand how this kind of works. So insurance are a commission product. And a person may tell you, oh, I get paid through the company. You're not paying me directly. But as a matter of fact, they are getting paid and it is coming out of your money because a lot of these products have these long surrender schedules. So they're keeping your money captive essentially in order to pay the agent for the most part. So I would just warn everyone, be careful of that. Asking the question, how is your advisor getting paid, as Nee brought up, is a great question to ask. Now, besides insurance, go ahead.
Can I just, you know, it gets worse though, right?
Tell me about it. Talk to me.
So I'm telling you, I am learning through the school of hard knocks. So just really quickly, we find another advisor. I don't ask, you know, what type of plannery he is, if he's, you know, commission based or what have you. But basically, I tell him about my experience with the other, with the previous planner or with the previous advisor who's, you know, got me into these huge, you know, cash value plans. And just, you know, silver lining, I was able to get at least 90% of my money back, actually. So that was the silver lining. And we got the majority of our money back and we put it into our loans. So the surrender value wasn't too bad on that one. This new advisor actually said I was abused by the previous person. Okay. Said I was abused by the previous person. Said that cash value life insurance is not as bad as I think it is, but I was abused. He sold it to me wrong. And got me and my wife into another cash value plan with higher surrender values. So now it's to the point where, look, I was just stupid for doing it, right? So after a year, we just said, this is stupid. We literally have wasted close to about $2,500 each. And because the surrender value was so high, we couldn't get any of our money back. So it's just gone. And that was it. That was the liberating moment. I just said, look, I have spent way too much money literally letting someone guide me blindly through this process. It will never happen again. So that's why when people hear me on different podcasts or people read some of my posts, I am so staunchly opposed to cash value. Part of it is an emotional, visceral reaction that I have for me being so stupid for going into that again. But also at the same time, not educating myself about it. But, you know, look, I'm not going to say that cash value, all cash value plans are bad, but you have to understand that there are very, you know, specific moments or very specific reasons or rationales for when you need it. And I think at least from a young graduating, newly minted attending, I don't think that they really qualify for that. That's not really necessary.
Alrighty, so that is the end of part one. Hope you loved it. There is even more great stuff coming tomorrow in part two. So make sure to check that out.